I should have gone to see Mother sooner, I suppose. But her letters had been arriving with the same regularity as always. So I had no inkling that anything might be wrong. Truly, Mother's letters were cheerful as ever. She writes such lovely descriptions of the winter birds at the feeder outside the solarium. Elizabeth Gauthreau, A Morbid Craving. Welcome to Tea, Toast, and Trivia. Thank you for listening in. I am your host, Rebecca Budd, and I look forward to sharing this moment with you. I am delighted and thrilled that my dear friend, writer, and poet, Elizabeth Gauthreau, has come back to share her insights on the art of writing a short story. We are once again bridging the 3,897 kilometers as the crow flies between New Hampshire and Vancouver. Liz is a gifted writer who specializes in fiction and poetry that delves into the themes of family and place. With a bachelor's degree in English writing from Old Dominion University and a master's degree in English fiction writing from the University of New Hampshire, she has honed her skills and crafted a compelling body of work. I read Liz's short story, A Morbid Craving, published by Lamplit Underground, several times over the past weeks. Her ability to capture four distinct points of view within a very complex narrative is riveting. It is time to put the kettle on and add to this exciting conversation. Welcome, Liz. Thank you for joining me today. It is a pleasure and privilege to have you here to talk about the art of writing short stories.
Thank you, Rebecca. I'm very pleased to be here. I always enjoy our conversations.
What drew you to the short story format?
The short story has been my go-to genre for years. It actually was Mr. Cote's ninth grade English class. He assigned William Faulkner's Barn Burning. I read that story and it was like an entire world opened up to me. This is literature. I was so excited. As I read more of his work, what I so admire about what he's able to do and other writers, but he in particular, is that his stories are grounded in the real world. This is Mississippi during that period of time. But at the same time, that story, those characters could not exist outside of his pages. And so he has one foot in either world. And that's something I just so admire about his writing.
How do you approach developing characters in your short stories? In A Morbid Craving, you had Lavinia, the daughter, Burton, the son, Alfred, the husband, and Mrs. Pierce, the caregiver, and they surrounded Irene. Could you comment on that?
I had to think about this question. My initial reaction was, well, I didn't really develop them. They're here. That's the reaction that I had when I reread the story. These people are real. For me to develop characters, I usually start with a character and a situation that I would like to explore. The way I have to start it is I have to develop their physical world. I have to be able to see it, to smell it, to hear it, in order to have them in there living their lives. I have to create that world first, even if some of the detail gets cut out later. So that's basically what I do, and use the same kinds of craft things of dialogue, facial expression, body movement, and all of that kind of thing. I do a lot of interior monologue as well. I know I have the character right when I read a draft and say, no, she wouldn't have said that. Or, no, she wouldn't have done that. Or, wait a minute, that's what I think. That's not what she thinks. I know I've got my character down when that happens.
You indicated that this story represented several firsts for you as a fiction writer.
I had tried to do multiple points of view for years in short stories and had never been able to pull it off for some reason. And the way that I was taught was pretty much the go-to narrative stance is third-person limited omniscience, which I guess they call third-person deep or something like that, or first-person. I guess the reason that I ended up with those four point-of-view characters was because of the situation. It was really about the family. Normally, I would have written, say, from Irene's point of view, but that wasn't the story. This story was how that family dealt with that situation.
You also wrote it in the form of diary entries.
Yes, I did. And if I want to know what happened during that time in the 1890s, people would record their innermost thoughts, things that happened during the day in their diary. That felt like the most believable way of presenting these four characters as they were going through the situation.
You were inspired by a death certificate.
At the time, I was doing a genealogy blog, and one of the ones that I followed posted the story, including the death certificate of this more distant relative for him. He wrote in the blog post what he was surmising and what he could gather from additional research was the situation that happened to that woman. When she died, no member of her family was the reporting person. She wasn't living with a family member, and she had had more than one doctor. The death certificate, the cause of death was starvation, and then the contributing cause was addiction to morphine. It was just so horrific that someone would starve to death because of this addiction.
This wasn't a story that belonged to the 1800s or the 1900s. You wrote a story that was meant for our time. Your ability to take all of this information and put it into the words of four people brought it together, and you connected us to the past.
I saw the connection to the current day after I'd finished the story. I guess the other thing that I would add is I was so fortunate to find this extremely obscure medical internet archive from the 1870s because it really gave me what I needed, the actual physical symptoms, the emotional reactions of these patients and their families. That was written by a doctor who specialized in treating morphine addiction. We have access to information now in the digital age that we never would have before. We could have stumbled on it if we'd gone to the basement of a library, maybe. That's another thing that is wonderful to be a writer right now.
How do you decide on the endings of your short stories?
I write the story because I don't know the ending. I'm intrigued by a particular situation or someone's emotional reaction or someone behaved in a way that doesn't make any sense. That's why I write the story, to discover the answer. I don't decide in advance. I have to let the characters work through the situation that they're in order to get to a place of resolution. When I know that the story is finished, there's little click inside my chest that says, okay, it's resolved. It's a physical feeling that tells me the story's finished.
Would you honor us with reading a passage from your short story, A Morbid Craving?
I would be happy to. This section that I'm going to read is from the point of view of Mrs. Pierce, who is the family's housekeeper, and she has become Irene's caregiver by necessity. So this particular diary entry is from her. Friday, October 9th, 1896. I chose my words very carefully that day. Ladies, I said, ladies of a delicate constitution may go off their food from time to time. You mustn't worry. Mr. Crichton was having none of it. Nonsense. My wife is not a colicky horse. Something is wrong, and I will thank you to tell me what it is. I'm sorry, sir, I said, but if you don't know what is troubling your wife, it is not my place to tell you. I couldn't tell him. I just couldn't. He turned his back on me and went up the stairs. With each resolute footfall on the stair, I feared for Mrs. Crichton, for her weakened condition and the state of her mind. Her husband's footsteps continued down the hall, just as resolute. Now they entered the bedroom, his angry voice demanding the cause of the change in her, she refusing to tell him. Oh, she would refuse to tell him. She would refuse to tell him because telling him meant being denied, and being denied meant terrible suffering. Suffering a man like Mr. Crichton could never imagine. He was in their bedroom. I could hear them arguing. She was pleading for her life. Do you hear me? Pleading for her life. Then I heard the yank of the chain and the sound of water rushing down, down, down into the depths of the sewer, relief forever out of reach. I was still standing at the foot of the stairs, hanging onto the newel post for dear life as I peered up the stairwell. Then I heard Mr. Crichton shouting my name. Mrs. Pierce! Mrs. Pierce, get up here! I trudged up those stairs as if a gallows awaited me at the top. There would be no hood for my face. I would have to watch as it all unfolded. I stood at the threshold of their bedroom, not wanting to enter the room. Mrs. Crichton was lying in bed, looking more afraid than a human being should ever have to look. I couldn't even begin to describe that kind of fear to you. Mr. Crichton's face was set in the expression of a man who has come to a decision and will not be moved. Now listen to me, Mrs. Pierce. This appalling business ends here. Do you hear me? It ends now. No matter how much my wife begs you for relief, you are not to give it to her. I didn't respond. I just stood at Mrs. Crichton's bedside as we both waited for her husband to leave. When he was gone, she looked at me and whispered, "What are we to do?" "I don't know. Could we try once more?" "I don't think I can." She closed her eyes. "Do you think he'll try to put me in a sanitarium?" "If nothing changes, then yes, I think he will." She opened her eyes. "All right then." And so we began our vigil. I would read to her from the Book of Psalms to take her mind off what was to come. I summoned my best reading voice to move her mind into the cadence of the verse. If only her mind could stay there, beside the still waters, out of sight of the valley of death. All too soon, the shivering began. I covered her with another blanket and kept on reading. She interrupted me to complain of headache, to bemoan the state of her poor stomach. I laid a cloth soaked in cool water across her forehead and kept on reading. She flung the cloth from her head and complained of itching in her limbs, the most terrible itching from the inside out that no scratch could reach or relieve. I stopped reading and walked her about the room, took her to the toilet. I settled her back in bed and resumed reading. Then the moaning for morphia began, followed by wailing, crying, begging, the most piteous pleading. I read the Psalms all the louder, as if these ancient verses could harden my heart against her suffering. When Mr. Crichton returned home at the end of the day, I informed him that there would be no supper prepared for him, and I fled the house.
The idea of morphia and morphine was prevalent in that age. Could you comment on that research that you did on morphine during that time?
The background that I read was that during the Civil War, morphine was discovered as a painkiller, and it really was considered a miracle drug. Doctors would prescribe it for different kinds of pain. They didn't know how addictive it was. The last section of the medical treatise that I read discussed this doctor's experiments on small animals and birds about the physical effects of morphine addiction. It was just incredible.
How did someone like Irene get involved with morphine?
She had neuralgia, and her doctor prescribed morphine to treat it as a matter of course. People could obtain it from the pharmacy. It was easy to get. It started very innocently.
What is it that you would like to leave with the reader of this short story?
I would like to leave the reader with compassion for every single person in this story. They went through a horrendous, horrendous time, every single one of them.
That's exactly how I felt. You did not assess blame in any of these characters. They just evolved as the circumstances evolved. That is a compelling message. Having these discussions allows us to explore our own thoughts and feelings and perhaps become, as you said, more compassionate.
I certainly hope my work has that effect.
Thank you for joining Liz and me on Tea, Toast, and Trivia. And a very special thank you, Liz, for sharing your insights on the art of writing short stories. Your reading was remarkable. You continue to inspire me. Listeners, you can meet up with Liz on her website, lizgaffreau.com, on Amazon, and Goodreads. You are only an internet click away from a place where stories dwell. Until next time we meet, dear friends, safe travels wherever your adventures lead you.